Welcome to NSL Unscripted, a national security law podcast, brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's The Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. We bring you conversations and hot topics from NSL practitioners today and hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to another episode of NSL Unscripted. I'm your host, Major Brian Jones, Associate Professor in the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Today, I'm delighted to talk with Professor Vinita Singh, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Iowa College of Law. Professor Singh, thanks for joining us and welcome to NSL Unscripted.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to share my work with you and your listeners.
Professor Singh graduated from the University of Iowa College of Law and subsequently earned an LLM in National Security Law from Georgetown University. Professor Singh recently joined the University of Iowa College of Law faculty, where she'll be teaching and researching in the fields of taxation, economic statecraft, and national security. The focus of today's discussion is Professor Singh's article, Louboutin Lawfare, Exploring Conceptions of Sanctions Utility Through Export Controls on Luxury Goods, which will soon be published in the Northwestern University Law Review. Professor Singh, we're going to dive into the details of your article, but why don't you set the stage for our listeners with a quick overview?
Yes, absolutely. So my work essentially confronts the paradox that currently sits at the heart of sanctions use today. There's almost a general consensus today among scholars and policymakers that sanctions are just not an effective foreign policy tool. They just don't work. Yet despite this widespread perception, sanctions are actually being deployed by states at an increasingly frequent rate, especially by the United States. So my work really asks why, if we agree that these measures don't work, right? Why do we continue to turn to them to affect our foreign policy and our national security goals? And really the way that I answer or resolve this conundrum is by arguing that the predominant notion of sanctioned success really is unduly limited, right? It primarily focuses on sanctions' ability to change the behavior of sanctioned parties in a way that is desired by the sanctioner. But in focusing solely on this outcome, right, it's myopic, right? It emphasizes unrealistic results while disregarding a wide range of alternative benefits that sanctions offer that are real and meaningful. Beyond making this argument, my work pulls insights from the field of international relations to propose alternative conceptions of sanctions utility that really are intended essentially to illustrate the wide range of benefits that sanctions can offer beyond simply modifying targets' behavior. And really, my work is intended just as a starting point for a paradigm shift in the way that we conceive of sanctions utility. And hopefully, through this paradigm shift, we'll be able to wield sanctions and assess sanctions more pragmatically.
What led you to research and write about this issue?
My initial interest in sanctions as a foreign policy and national security tool really started when it was widely debated how the United States and European Union should respond to Russia's heightened aggression against Ukraine. Right. So as Russia was amassing troops on the border with Ukraine, right, there was a lot of discussion, just very wide and public discussion about how the U.S. and European Union should respond in the case that it actually invaded Ukraine. And as a part of this debate, there was a lot of discussions of sanctions and sanctions utility, right? There were a number of policymakers and pundits that were strongly advocating for the aggressive use of sanctions, but there were people on the other side as well who were vehemently asserting, right, sanctions are a very hollow response, right? They're not going to move the needle in any way. Ultimately, as we know, the U.S. and European Union did respond through very aggressive, comprehensive sanctions packages. And at the beginning of that sanctions campaign, officials from European Union, as well as the United States, were very confident that those sanctions packages would really exert significant economic pressure on Russia that could be significant enough to cause it to desist in its aggression. At that point in time, I was very interested in, well, let's see how this works. This could be really, really quite an interesting outcome. But I moved from just like mere interest in this discourse into thinking about really writing about sanctions utility when I became familiar with export controls that were a part of these sanctions packages that were intended to limit the movement of luxury goods into Russia, right? So I'm thinking, okay, luxury goods, limiting access to luxury goods, how is this really going to do anything? Because, you know, on the one hand, you had sanctions that really packed a punch, right? Sanctions that were intended to freeze assets, that were in intended to be swift financial institutions in Russia. And then on the other hand, you have these like export controls on luxury goods that really boil down to, well, what happens as a result, right? You don't get any Louis Vuitton handbags. You don't get any Dom Perignon anymore, or any Bentleys. To me, it was not clear what the intent of the sanctions were. So that's, well, that aspect of the sanctions, that is what was. So that's a point in time where I started to really wonder, okay, what is the purpose of these sanctions? How do we conceive of sanctions utility more broadly? And I started to really engage with this paradox that is at the heart of my work.
Just to baseline listeners here, the definition you use of sanctions in your paper is the deliberate government-inspired withdrawal or threat of withdrawal of customary trade or financial relations. And then you use a couple of terms in your paper. The senders would be the countries that are imposing the sanctions, and then the targets would be the countries that are being sanctioned by the senders. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. Yeah. Just to refine that a little bit. So in terms of the targets, often when we say targets, we mean states that are the recipients of sanctions. But sometimes sanctions can be a little bit more pointed in terms of maybe targeting influence actors or members of elites in an autocratic regime, in which case I would argue that those would be the targets rather than the entire state itself. But other than that, yes.
And with respect to the sanctions on luxury goods, you mentioned several times in your article about sort of the oligarch class that exists in Russia, the wealthy folks that are perhaps tacitly supporting the Putin regime. And so talk a little bit more about these luxury goods sanctions and who the senders are in your article, and then who are the principal targets.
Yes. Yeah. So in advancing my central argument, really what I do is I use those export controls on luxury goods that I just mentioned as a case study. These are export controls that can be divided into two separate regimes, right? So one is export controls that the United States has levied, the other that the European has levied. And both of these sanctions were deployed in the middle of March of 2022, so a few weeks after Russia's special military operation was started. So very generally, the way that they operate is by limiting the movement of a wide range of luxury goods into Russia. And these goods like run the gamut. So they include, amongst other things, things like alcohol, apparel and footwear, handbags, cars, artwork, jewelry, watches even. There are meaningful distinctions in the scope of the EU measures and the US measures. For instance, while the US measures also target the movement of luxury goods to specific influence actors, which are named members of the Russian oligarch class, the EU measures don't extend that far, does not target movement of goods into the hands of specific people, rather just movement of goods into Russia itself. There are also important jurisdictional differences in the scope of both of the measures, but I won't go into them. Suffice it to say, they limit the movement of luxury goods into Russia very generally.
You discuss in your article, measuring the effectiveness of sanctions historically has been kind of an art and a science. And how has the effectiveness of sanctions historically been assessed?
The majority of sanctions analysis that is engaged in by policymakers and scholars today, as well as in recent history, really evaluates the success of sanctions by reference to their ability to modify the target's behavior as desired by the sender. And I refer to this conception of sanction success as the behavioral modification paradigm in my work. So under the behavioral modification paradigm, sanctions are considered unsuccessful if a target does not alter their conduct as preferred by the sender. So this means that sanctions are unsuccessful even if they take a significant economic toll on the target, and even if they provoke some type of change in behavior in the target, if that change in behavior is not what the sender really ultimately desired. As a metric for assessing sanction success, the behavioral modification paradigm is really difficult to accurately apply. I think perhaps the biggest issue with measuring success under this metric is really causation, right? Causation is very difficult to pin down, right? Even if a target modifies its behavior as desired by a sender, it can be unclear whether the change is really a direct response to the sanctions themselves or other factors, or maybe a combination of both. This is especially true as time passes, right? So the window of assessment becomes wider. And then of course, where you have multiple sanctions being levied in layered forms, maybe even contemporaneously, it can be difficult to assess, you know, which aspect of the sanctions package actually contributed to behavioral modification and which did not. So where scholars have been able to assess sanctions under the behavioral modification paradigm, these scholars have generally concluded that sanctions are largely unsuccessful. For instance, scholars from the Peterson Institute for International Economics that have engaged in this type of sanctions analysis really for decades estimate that on average, only 34% of deployed sanctions are successful at modifying target behavior in a manner that's desirable to the sender. And this value actually varies meaningfully when you start to analyze the data more particularly. Success increases a little bit where intended behavioral modification is just minor, right? So you impose sanctions because you want hostages to be released. But where intended behavioral modification is much more ambitious, the success rate drops almost precipitously. So where you impose sanctions to trigger a regime change, or you impose sanctions to impair military potential, there's a lot less likelihood that they are going to be successful. Stepping away from these specific results, right, scholars have generally come to a consensus that sanctions are just unlikely to change target behavior in certain critical circumstances. So for instance, where targets are autocratic, especially where they have stable political and economic systems, sanctions tend to not work as much. Moreover, sanctions are much less likely to change target behavior where the sender and the target don't have meaningful economic connections, so the sanctions aren't able to produce a meaningful economic impact. Notably, this is when we look at sanctions that are deployed in recent history, a substantial portion of these sanctions kind of involve these circumstances. They're targeted at autocratic regimes, right? They're deployed by senders that don't have relationships with targets. So as a result, a lot of these measures are not going to be able to produce the results that they're intended to produce, theoretically, if we think only success is behavioral modification.
So to the person looking at these sanctions, say the average American saying, well, the war continues to rage now over years into this conflict at this point, does that mean the sanctions were a failure in this case? Or in what do you propose as an alternate measuring stick to gauge the effectiveness of sanctions?
So applying the behavioral modification paradigm to assess success of the US and EU's export controls on luxury goods, it would appear that such export controls just have failed, right? So as you said, we're now more than 2 years out. The Russia-Ukraine war continues to rage. And to the extent that we don't believe the sanctions were intended to modify the behavior of the state at large, but to modify the behavior of Russian elites, right? We haven't seen a lot of defection by Russian elites from Putin's agenda, right? There have been a few people that have spoken out, but by and large, right, this oligarch class has remained relatively silent and continued to, you know, walk Putin's line. But this outcome really isn't surprising, right? From the time of their deployment, it's really hard to imagine how these export controls could have forced Russia to desist in its aggression, or could have forced, you know, Russian elites to defect in this way. Of course, there is the stereotype that Russians love luxury goods, right? But realistically, right, thinking about the sanctions at the time of their deployment, it doesn't seem like they would be sufficiently strong to cause either one of these outcomes. I argue really the weaknesses of these export controls were obvious, and under the behavioral modification paradigm specifically, right? And that indicates that it's likely these measures were intended to achieve goals other than behavioral modification. The reason that I use them as a case study just perfectly illustrate that we need alternative metrics for evaluating the success of sanctions, right? That properly accounts for sender objectives motivating deployment. Beyond making that argument, right, introduces alternative paradigms of sanctions utility, four of them.
Let's talk about those four paradigms that you propose in turn. Again, these are alternates to the classic behavioral modification paradigm. You start with the contribution paradigm. So tell us what that is and how you'd assess the success of sanctions under that paradigm.
So the first paradigm that I introduce in my work as an alternative to the behavioral modification paradigm is what I call the contribution paradigm. And under this paradigm, the objectives of sanctions really is to shape international law. And that can be whether we're reaffirming pre-existing customary international law, whether we're clarifying pre-existing customary international law, or we're contributing to the crystallization of new customary international law. As such, right, the contribution paradigm finds value in sanctions regardless of whether they actually change target behavior. And this paradigm, unsurprisingly, you've probably noticed, is rooted in the unique nature of customary international law, right? And we know customary international law exists where there's widespread state practice that's engaged in by states under the belief it's required by law. So because customary international law is based on state practice, it really contains laws that are amorphous and dynamic. So ongoing state practice constantly redefines customary international law, adding greater nuance to pre-existing rules of customary international law, or contributing to the crystallization of new customary international law. The contribution paradigm posits that as a form of internationally facing state action or state practice, sanctions can be one aspect of the state practice that contributes to the refining of customary international law or the crystallization of new customary international law. Moreover, in this capacity, It can also aid in preservation of pre-existing customary international law in the case of challenges to the international order, because we know that states can actually unspool customary international law through availing themselves of what's known as the subsequent objector doctrine, which essentially provides that states gain an exemption from a rule of customary international law if and to the extent their departure from this rule is not opposed by other states. Theoretically, it is possible that where a material number of states deviate from a rule of customary international law, and that deviation is met with acquiescence from other states, right, that previously observed such rule of customary international law, that rule is essentially unmade. So with this doctrine in mind, right, actions that clearly contest another state's deviation from customary international law, such as sanctions that are issued in response to a derogation from international law, really take on new importance. Not only would such sanctions work to bar deviating states from taking advantage of the subsequent objector doctrine, but in doing so, they obstruct basically any related unspooling of pre-existing customary international law.
So apply that here to the Russia example. You talk about, in this case, these sanctions were deployed to preserve the customary international law prohibition on the use of force. Assess that with respect to these sanctions.
So just kind of stepping back, under the contribution paradigm, right, sanctions are considered successful when they clearly communicate the sender's understanding of customary international law to the broader international community. So customary international law really only evolves, right, or maybe is preserved as well, where both state practice and opinio iuris, right, are easily ascertainable. So bare deployment of sanctions without any type of explanation for your reason for doing so is not sufficient for success under the contribution paradigm. Really, you have to offer an explanation that speaks to your understanding of customary international law. And moreover, right, the sanctions as well as this explanation have to be accessible to international audiences so they get the message that you're trying to send, your intent to contribute to customary international law. So here, right, at the point that these sanctions were deployed, both the European Union and the United States made statements that indicated they were being deployed in response to Russia's derogation from this prohibition against unprovoked aggression, which we recognize as a facet of customary international law. Their explanations for imposing these sanctions were very clear, indicated they respected this pre-existing rule of international law, indicated that they believed Russia had derogated from this international law, and indicated that that derogation was unlawful, right, under international law. So in that sense, I do believe the sanctions had the power of contributing to the development, well, not even the development, right, the preservation of this pre-existing customary international law. It is possible that both sender entities, right, the United States and then the European Union, may have intended to contribute to other facets of customary international law through issuing these measures, but looking at their explanations for, you know, deploying these luxury controls, we don't have sufficient, you know, indication that there was intent to contribute to other facets of customary international law. So to the extent that EU and US were trying to contribute to other facets of what I call CIL, I've been saying customary international law repeatedly for a while now.
CIL is fine.
CIL, yes. To the extent that US and EU were trying to contribute to other aspects of CIL, I would argue that the sanctions were not effective under the contribution paradigm.
Let's shift to your second paradigm. You call it the signaling paradigm. What is this view? And similar to the last question, how do you assess the success of sanctions under this approach?
My second proposed alternative use for sanctions, I call the signaling paradigms. And under the signaling paradigm, right, the objective of sanctions is primarily to communicate messages to an audience of critical actors, right? So that includes targets, right? The people that the sanctions are aimed at or the entities the sanctions are aimed at, victims, allies, domestic constituents, as well as the broader international community. So as such, the signaling paradigm finds value in sanctions that effectively convey various messages to key actors, regardless of whether they're able to coerce changes in target behavior. I want to clarify that the signaling paradigm is not something that I came up with on my own. Currently, there is a small portion of academic literature related to success of sanctions that examines sanctions' ability to signal. They don't call, you know, that measure of success the signaling paradigm. That's my own moniker. But they do kind of interrogate this paradox that really is at the heart of my work and their solution to the conundrum of why do we continue to use sanctions if we agree they don't work under behavioral modification. investigation is because they have this power to signal, right? Sanctions can symbolize different things to different constituents. They can signal condemnation, solidarity, resolve to action. And once these messages are communicated through deployment of sanctions, right, they influence the broader status quo by altering the perception of a wide range of observers, right? So let's consider, right, how do sanctions signal to domestic constituencies? As the output of a domestic compromise, right, sanctions function to both react to domestic constituencies and their differing levels of influence and power, as well as inform domestic constituencies of the ways in which their preferences are factored into the state's broader interests and policies. And then when we think of what can sanctions signal to international audiences, right, sanctions decrease asymmetries of information on the international level because they inform international audiences of the sender's willingness to engage in various forms of conduct in light of constraints on their action posed by domestic constituencies. Sanctions provide foreign observers with insight into the sender's range of responsive action, including collective action, which is helpful in strategizing their own future conduct.
And can you talk about how these messages need to be deployed so that they're visible to the various audiences that you've discussed?
Sanctions are considered successful under the signaling paradigm where they clearly communicate a sender's desired messages to intended audiences. Like the contribution paradigm, success under the signaling paradigm requires meeting both formal and substantive elements that are connected with the institution of such measures. Formally, sanctions must be deployed in a manner that's visible to intended audiences to achieve success under the signaling paradigm. Substantively, right, the sanctions need to convey the substantive messages that the sender desires to send to the relevant audiences. And this can be done in various ways, like the contribution paradigm, right? These sanctions can be accompanied by explanations that clarify the purpose of their deployment. But also, it is possible for the substance of the sanctions themselves to convey messages. Audiences, you know, looking at the actual operation of the sanctions can get an understanding of why they were deployed and what messages they're sending.
Can you assess under your metric for this, the success of these sanctions under the signaling paradigm?
I would say that the export controls on luxury goods do a great job of sending a variety of messages, both by reaffirming messages and by sending new messages to various audiences. In terms of messaging to the victims of this aggression, the sanctions indicate and reaffirm messages that the United States and the EU have already sent, essentially that they support efforts to resist Russian aggression beyond mere words. To the Russian government, right, they express condemnation of the invasion as manifested through their actions. And this is, again, a reaffirmation of messages that they've already sent through other sanctions packages and other measures that were responsive to the special military operation. To Russian elites, they message an intent to cut influence actors off from the international market to prevent profit from Russia's ill-gotten gains. And then to domestic audiences, they signal a support for Ukraine, but also a resolve to act wisely by first exhaustively exploring non-forcible efforts to deter Russian aggression. And then we can look for perhaps a fifth message, which is a message to other states, which is an intent to oppose any similar future aggression by other states, including through narrowly targeting influence actors benefiting from a corrupt state. And it's possible that these export controls on luxury goods also sent alternative messages. We would have to assess their success by applying, you know, those formal and substantive requirements necessary to determine whether signaling has been effective. But my work really explores five messages specifically.
Let's transition to your third approach. You call it the internalization paradigm. Tell us about this approach and how you measure effectiveness under it.
So the internalization paradigm is my favorite paradigm of the four that I present, but essentially it posits that the objective of sanctions is primarily to bring international norms home by influencing actors over whom senders have jurisdiction to incorporate international norms, including those contained in international law, within their own internal value systems. Once internalized, domestic actors can calculate their behavior with these norms as a given, and then by doing so, they effectively reaffirm these norms and ensure their continuity on both domestic and international level. Unlike the behavioral modification paradigm, the internalization paradigm is actually inwardly facing. It examines the way in which sanctions impact the conduct and value of domestic actors. It's similar to the behavioral modification paradigm in the sense that it does change, or it does, excuse me, it does observe changes in behavior, but the changes in behavior that it observes is not changes in the behavior of a target, but changes in the behavior of domestic constituencies. Consider promulgating law that prohibits particular conduct, for instance, requiring seatbelts, right, for drivers to wear, right? And failure to adhere to these rules results in a legal penalty. Basically, drivers have a strong inducement to avoid not wearing their seatbelts, right? Because they don't want to be punished. So where avoidance becomes habitual, the norm of avoidance, right, the norm of wearing your seatbelt is incorporated into the actor's value systems over time, and it becomes internalized, right? Thereafter, right, domestic actors, drivers, are going to make decisions predicated on wearing their seatbelt, right? When they get in the car, they'll wear their seatbelt. They'll ensure that they're in the car with somebody who is also wearing a seatbelt. But in the process of doing so, right, they're going to reaffirm the validity and continuity of this norm, right? The norm of wearing the seatbelt, right? So leveraging this mechanism of internalization through deploying sanctions, states can really shift the interests of their own populations to support compliance with international norms.
You spoke about internalizing norms using the seatbelt example for an average citizen. Could you broaden that to talk about maybe some norm institutionalization amongst commercial entities?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very relevant to what my work focuses on with these export controls on luxury goods. Consider, for instance, right, the impact on economic actors of domestic legislation that implements, right, a new bilateral trade agreement. To the extent that domestic economic groups reorient their behavior around this new legally driven norm, right, that is related to this bilateral trade agreement, right, making investments in economic activity that's predicated on the continued validity of these norms contained in this bilateral trade agreement, the norms are internal. Right. So when a state implements a trade liberalization agreement, right, the resulting import competition eliminates some domestic firms that oppose liberalization, right? It causes others to adjust in ways that they can operate within this new, more liberalized environment, right? And it expands or creates exporting firms that really benefit from free trade. So the result is greater support and enforcement for trade liberalization that will persist into the future. So if at some point, right, a politician or a policymaker proposes, right, stepping back from trade liberalization, right, you have all these pre-existing economic groups that have an interest in lobbying against such a change in policy. And in doing so, right, they're going to ensure the continued validity of these values and norms.
Can you talk about the response? You devote a section about this in your paper of various commercial entities pulling their business, ceasing operations in Russia around the 2022 timeframe, and how you kind of link that to the internalization paradigm.
Yes, kind of stepping back to ask, you know, how do we assess success under the internalization paradigm? Basically, right, sanctions are successful under the internalization paradigm, where they force domestic constituencies to really internalize the international norms that senders are hoping to bring home. But here, success isn't measured by mere compliance with sanctions, right? Really, success is assessed through examining whether the affected private sector ecosystems have actually evolved in a manner that confirms broader internalization, right? This evolution can be manifested in a number of ways, but my work really examines three of those ways, right? So first, I posit, right, that success is achieved where affected private sector ecosystems experience, right, the death of businesses that are reliant on sanctioned conduct. As enterprises dependent on sanctioned conduct either learn how to thrive through other avenues or become defunct, right, the relevant environment evolves away from engagement in that type of conduct. Second, my work posits that success is achieved under the internalization paradigm, where a business within the affected private sector ecosystem changes their broader decision-making calculus to incorporate the norms incentivized by sanctions into the decisions that they make regarding conduct unrelated to such measures, right? So consider, I think this is one example that I offer in my paper, is a sender state issues sanctions against a target that basically prevent the sender state's textile businesses from buying textiles from the target, specifically because the target is supporting and allowing child labor, right? So the purpose of the measures is to force internalization of a norm against buying products made with child labor, right? So these textile businesses within the sender state stop buying textiles from the target state that are made with child labor, but also, and thinking about, you know, what textiles are going to work with in the future, they make the decision not to purchase textiles textiles made with child labor that are sold by other countries that are not the target, right? So that would indicate that there's an internalization of a norm against, you know, buying products that are made with child labor. Third, I would argue that success is achieved where private sector ecosystems continue to refrain from previously prohibited conduct, even once sanctions are lifted, right? So what previously appeared to be mere compliance while sanctions were enforced, right, emerges as an internalized norm. Like the behavioral modification paradigm, right, the internalization paradigm analyzes conduct when evaluating sanction success. But like I said, right, the conduct that it analyzes is not target conduct, but changes in the conduct of domestic constituencies. This can be, similar to the behavioral modification paradigm, difficult to assess successfully, right? And I think the major problem is that causation is once again an issue. Changes in the conduct of private sector environments can be driven by both legal internalization, but also by unrelated factors, right? So supply chain difficulties, emergence of new technology, changes in the law that's not connected to sanctions, right? Or even social pressure, right? Can all drive changes in the value systems of targeted private sector ecosystems. When I say targeted private sector ecosystems, I don't mean targets. I mean the constituents that senders are hoping to bring international norms home to.
In your paper, you talk about how it can take some time to really measure the effectiveness under the internalization paradigm. Can you discuss that?
Yes. So I think that the difficulties of assessing sanctions under the internalization paradigm are very similar to those under the behavioral modification paradigm. The biggest issue is we're looking at changes in someone's behavior, right? Under the behavioral modification paradigm, it's the target's behavior. But under the internalization paradigm, it's the behavior of domestic constituencies, right? So we still have an issue with causation in the same way that we do with the behavioral modification paradigm, right? What is causing the internalization? Is it the sanctions or is it alternative factors that are occurring contemporaneously? Right. And when we're thinking about constituencies such as business environments, there are a number of unrelated factors that can drive what appears to be internalization of norms, things like supply chain difficulties, right? Emergence of new technology, changes in the law unconnected with sanctions, or even social pressure, right? So it's hard sometimes to extricate, right? What is causing the outcome that we desire, right? Is it the sanctions or are these other factors? I think another difficulty too, like you mentioned, right, is we need to have time for these sanctions to percolate and to push these norms into the internal value sets of these domestic constituencies. So sanctions that are very brief in time are unlikely to be successful under the internalization paradigm. The good thing though about the internalization paradigm is that even though success can't be achieved immediately, right, it could be forthcoming in the future as long as sanctions remain in force. And I believe you asked me as well, how successful are these luxury export controls under the internalization paradigm? And really my analysis is it's inconclusive whether these export controls are successful under the internalization paradigm. And a big part of that is because it's difficult to extricate, you know, what is causing internalization. At the beginning of the heightening of the Russo-Ukraine war, there was a lot of social pressure on businesses from just domestic populations, as well as NGOs and a bunch of rights organizations to withdraw business from or to stop doing business in Russia or with Russians, right? So as a result, right, even before the export controls were deployed, we saw a lot of luxury brands either temporarily stop their business in Russia or just close their stores, right, in Russia. After the luxury goods were deployed, we saw some kind of heightening behavior or some further, you know, movement of these businesses away from Russia. But it's not clear, right, whether or not this was caused by prolonged social pressure, whether this was caused by alternative things that were happening at the same time. For instance, right, there were other sanctions, like the de-swifting sanctions, that could have harmed their business or made it impossible to do business in Russia. So they just decided contemporaneously with deployment of these luxury controls that it would just be better from a business perspective to just cut their ties with Russia. Similarly, right, there are a lot of other private sector organizations that these luxury goods companies, right, are reliant on that had also ceased doing business in Russia, right? So logistics companies like Visa and MasterCard, right? Businesses that are pretty critical to getting your goods into that area and moving your goods within Russia, as well as getting the money that you need to be paid for selling those goods. At this point in time, it's really not clear whether or not these export controls were successful at pressuring constituencies, domestic constituencies, to change their value systems, to embrace values against doing business with countries that engage in this type of unprovoked aggression. But it is possible, right, that as time passes, right, we'll be able to understand more about whether internalization has been successful or not. And this includes where sanctions are lifted, right? How will these businesses act once these sanctions are gone, right? Will they immediately flood back into the Russian market, or will they kind of hold back, which might be expressive of an internalized norm if they do hold back?
Right. It seems like the critical measuring point for that would be after the cessation of hostilities in this case.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Let's shift and talk about your fourth and final paradigm. You call it the power paradigm. Can you explain this approach?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So the power paradigm really posits that sanctions can be used to preserve or shift the global balance of power, right? And this is achieved by limiting the target's ability to access or harness resources that imbue the state with global power. Under the power paradigm, sanctions are considered successful where they impact, like I said, a target's access to one or more resources of power. And when I say sources of power, right, I don't only mean military might and wealth, but their proxies, right? So population, arms, valuable natural resources, et cetera. And then similarly, when I say access, right, I don't just mean the ability to acquire, right, sources of power, but the ability to leverage these sources of power. So for instance, if you were able to get your hands on, you were able to acquire a number of natural resources, right? If you weren't able to sell them, right, for instance, you wouldn't really be able to access the worth of these natural resources. If a sender was able to prevent a target from acquiring or from leveraging natural resources, that would be a way in which that they a way in which they limited the target's access to sources of power.
You mentioned a critical part in this is the extent of the trading relationship between a target and a sender. And can you just touch on what the current, or I guess in 2022, the trading relationship was between the United States and Russia?
Yes. So success under this paradigm really appears differently based on whether the sender desires to preserve or to shift the relative balance of power between itself and the target. So where a sender intends to preserve the pre-existing balance of power, sanctions are deemed successful where they hold a target's access to sources of power static. But where a sender intends to shift the balance of power between itself and a target, sanctions would be considered successful where they materially constrain a target's access to one or more sources of power. This means generally, right, in our minds, we would think that success under the power paradigm is probably unlikely unless there's a material trading relationship between the sender and the target. But it is possible in rare circumstances where a non-trading relationship between two states can also be wielded to impact a target's access to sources of power. An example that I give in my work specifically is consider state X and state Y. So state Y has access to a lot of natural resources, but is essentially landlocked or landlocked by state X. So it's reliant on railroads within state X to get its natural resources to, an international market for those resources. So to the extent that State X says, you're not able to use our railroads anymore, right? They would be able to, materially impact State Y's access to sources of power. They would be, those limitations on rail travel would probably be very successful under the power paradigm. So here, right, when we look at the export controls on luxury goods, it's a very interesting situation because Russia doesn't get a lot of its luxury goods from the United States. It gets many more from the European Union, but there are limits jurisdictionally on how powerful the European Union export controls are. So it is possible for Russians and the state as a whole to give the sanctions runaround by using third-party countries as intermediaries and getting goods. Interestingly, right, I think is the realization that luxury goods actually can be a good proxy for wealth. A lot of luxury goods hold their value very well and even appraise in price, or sorry, increase in price over time, whereas ordinary goods may not. So if you have a currency that you're worried about devaluing, right, a great way for you to preserve your wealth is to plug it into luxury goods such as handbags or scotches. Scotches apparently are a big one to preserve wealth. So here, right, I would argue that the US controls were not successful from the perspective of the limited trading relationship. US's controls did not materially impact Russia's ability to access luxury goods. And beyond that, to the extent that the EU impacted, right, access to luxury goods, the EU controls really didn't materially impact Russia's access to wealth in general. Yes, it impacted access to a proxy for wealth, which are luxury goods, but Russia has a large amount of wealth, right? And other resources or other proxies for wealth that it could leverage to maintain or gain power. And the EU controls on luxury goods were not materially impacting its ability to execute that function. So I would say the luxury controls, US and EU's controls, were not successful probably under the power paradigm, but there were other sanctions regimes that were successful under the power paradigm that would be considered unsuccessful under the behavioral modification paradigm. For instance, right, the de-swifting efforts of the US and EU probably would be considered successful under the power paradigm, right? Because it materially impacts the ability of Russian financial institutions to move capital, right? So to fulfill their goals as institutions, as well as to fulfill the goals of their clients, right? Similarly, limitations on the purchase of Russian oil, right, would probably have been impactful under the power paradigm because, right, oil is a much bigger proxy for wealth than luxury goods are, and Russia has a lot of oil. So limiting Russia's ability to turn those natural resources into cash, right, could have a tremendous impact under the power paradigm.
Thank you, Professor Singh. This has been a fascinating discussion, using this as a good case example to reassess the way people think about sanctions and their effectiveness moving forward. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research. Professor Singh's article, Louboutin Lawfare, Exploring Conceptions of Sanctions Utility Through Export Controls on Luxury Goods, will soon appear in the Northwestern University Law Review. Do you have a date in mind when that's going to be published?
I know that it's going to be probably in the springtime of 2025, but there is a draft on SSRN right now.
We'll share that when we post the podcast as well.
Wonderful.
So thanks so much for the discussion and for joining us on NSL Unscripted.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure being here and being able to share my work with you and your audience. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the NSL Unscripted podcast from the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Please subscribe and stay tuned for more episodes of NSL Unscripted.
This episode of NSL Unscripted was brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's The Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense or its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Our department also produces the Operational Law Handbook, accessible online. We hope you have enjoyed this episode and look forward to future episodes for NSL practitioners. Thank you.